Hello, everybody. My name is Sarah Longwell. Welcome to a French Village podcast. We are discussing episodes 1 and 2 of season 4, which means Renewed picked up for season 4. It has everything to do with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes. I heard from the powers that be that you are just really carrying the show, and people wanted more, so we're back for season 4. And for the first time, we have a special guest with us. A few weeks back, I was marveling on the show that I had received a package that was filled with just amazing replicas of. All from the show. I had my own personal ID. There was a flag from the resistance. I was pretty sure Ben had gotten one too. And so last week we said, hey, reach out to us, Fred Jacobs, and come on the show and tell us about the documents. And here he is. Hi, Fred.
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks for reaching out to me and thanks for producing the best podcast on the interwebs.
Thank you. I have so many questions about this package of material that we both received. But I want to start just by having you describe what was in it, because it's actually a pretty considerable package of material that, you know, if I ever get trapped in Vichy, France, and have to get through gendarme checkpoints, German checkpoints, if I have to prove that I'm not Jewish, which of course I am, it'll be super useful. So what did you include in there? And what does a full package of documents for survival in Villeneuve include?
Yes, it includes personal identity cards. It includes transportation passes. It includes food ration cards, it's really everything that you would need to on your person, you know, for daily life in a police state. Which is, quite something to think about. It's one of the most powerful effects of watching the show. So I thought you guys would find that really, really meaningful.
Yeah, so one thing it does not include, which is really important for this season, is an exemption card for forced labor in Germany. And I was wondering whether that was because you don't care whether Sarah and I get enslaved and sent to Germany, or whether that was just because those documents actually didn't exist.
It's neither of those. I was assuming that you guys would head for the woods and join the resistance. So I really wasn't too worried about that. But I did want you to have your rations of cheese and wine to take with you into the woods.
I think that's a good call. I think that it's true that we would be the woods resistance people. But here's my question. I have many. I mean, first of all, just a small register of complaint. I tried to use the food rations at Giant. They did not work. Nobody's taking them these days. So I don't know how authentic these replicas are. But wait, how did you start listening to the podcast, the show? And then I want to know where you got these documents.
Yes.
But so tell us.
Sure. I've been listening to both of you guys for, you know, as long as you've been podcasting. So, 5 or 6 years or, you know, however long it's been since early in the last, the presidential cycle. And I listen to, almost everything that you guys do, everything that I'm aware of. You might have some side projects that I'm not aware of.
But so like Bulwark and Lawfare?
Bulwark and Lawfare and, Rational Security and, you know.
You were my object lesson on Rational Security
this
week.
Yes, exactly. So, I guess you could... You know, I hesitate to use the word super fan, but let's just say the work that you guys have done has really meant a lot to me over the past couple of years, especially because it's smart and it's principled. In a time when both of those things are kind of in short supply. And and that's kind of what the French Village podcast is about as well. And I don't think it was an accident that you kind of were attracted to the show like that. I've started watching the show and listening because one of you guys mentioned that you were doing the podcast. So I just decided to check it out. And honestly, I would not have stuck with it past the first 30 seconds were it not for Sarah's enthusiasm about the show. But I was like, hey, if she finds something valuable here, I'm going to stick with it. And I'm really glad that I did.
Well, I just want to say, JVL, this proves that Sarah Longwell is always right. And your skepticism about the French Village podcast idea is hereby rebutted by listener sentiment, because I just want to say no one has ever made you a full complement of Vichy identification papers. So tell us about the identification papers. Do you have a background in document forgery, or what do you do for a living?
I would like to say, even if JVL asked at this point, I don't think I would make them for JVL.
He's the one, you know, with his whole Appalachian Trail thing, he's the one who's got the taking to the woods thing going now in the broader Bulwark cinematic universe.
I'll try to keep an open mind about that, but I really don't see it at the moment. What I do is I've worked with computers for most of my career. I started out making 3D computer graphics for broadcast with supercomputers, working in New York for quite some time. And after that, I was an early employee at a company that pioneered streaming media on the internet. Then went to grad school and got a job working with a nonprofit that helps amputees in developing countries get prosthetic limbs. These days I'm working on another software project and I'm doing some writing.
But where did you get into the document forgery?
Where did these come from? Yeah.
I mean, it's great cover, this software engineering thing you've got. You're like Berio, you know, by day, mild-mannered school principal. Where did you learn to forge Vichy documents?
Yeah. The blank documents came from a small memorabilia supplier in France. I wanted to get you guys something, and I located this woman in France who makes blank wartime documents. So she forged the blank documents. And as far as I can tell, it's just sort of like the way some people get Civil War, memorabilia, that kind of thing. I received them, I was like, well, you know, this is cool, but it needs to be a little bit more personalized for Sarah and Ben. So then I used my computer skills to create to document your wartime identities on the identity papers. So that's how we get, for example, the tattoo of Friedrich Hayek on Sarah's leg and Ben's tattoo of John Marshall.
So, my occupation, my French isn't great, right? But I understand that my occupation is as a cabaret singer.
That is correct. That you are a cabaret singer. I wonder if Ben was able to successfully translate his occupation.
The truth is, I don't have it in front of me, and I don't remember.
Well, your occupation was peasant.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That is, I mean, that's because I have a cabin in the woods and I plan canon activities. That was so accurate that it just didn't stick with me. It just seemed descriptive.
Yes, yes. I think it fit very well. And Sarah, as a cabaret singer, what can I say? I've heard stories about, what happens at your parties and so forth. And, so I just thought that would be a good one too.
And she's very into musicals. It's accurate.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it was such a delightful thing to receive. Usually when I open those packages, it's just filled with hate mail. And it was so, I was opening, it was like my team, and we were all in the office, and everybody was like, everybody was like freaking out. Oh. It was so, there's like a fingerprint on the ID card, yeah. And like it's so detailed.
Yeah.
And the one that always just kills me, because it's in the show so much, is the thing that they put on like the dashboard of their cars,
right.
To get across the bridge. Cause that, yes. It looks exactly like what it is, and you see it in the show all the time.
Right.
Love it.
The Ausweis. And I mean, the documents to me almost seem like characters in the show that kind of remind you about what it means to live in a police state. And, you know, when I held these things in my hand, it just seemed really, it seemed very real. So I'm glad, I'm really super glad that you guys got a lot out of it also.
Well, we appreciated it extremely. And, couldn't be more tickled that you came on the show to talk about it. So thank you for doing it. Thank you for
all your super fandom.
And yeah, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you guys.
Yeah. So why don't you mute yourself and just hang out with us? We're gonna jump in here and talk about the beginnings of season four, which I will just say, Ben. This is the sort of turning point of the series, right? It's our halfway point. We have, especially people don't know this yet, but the seventh season is shorter. It's like on the shorter side. So we are more than halfway through is my main point. And I will say, season three is a tough season, and it's nice to kind of open up into season four and meet a bunch of new people.
We're out of the Holocaust department and just into slavery. It's a breakthrough. We're just into the period where the Germans are trying to prolong the war for as long as possible. And it's a real relief.
It's a real relief. And I think, what's exciting to me is, the fourth season opens, and, obviously every time I see people that I'm, because you, whenever you watch a show that's this long, your memories are freshest of the people toward the end. And so when I saw Antoine in the beginning, I was like, there's Antoine. We're going to get to hang out with Antoine, because he's obviously, he's an important character throughout the rest of the series.
I didn't know that.
Spoiler alert, he's important. He's a mainish character. And so he has been introduced to us as the younger brother of Schwartz's new wife, who is the maid that he was having the affair-ish with, I guess. They don't go into too much detail about that. They kind of have an affair, and then they seem to be in a relationship, and now they're clearly married. And so Antoine is Schwartz's brother-in-law.
And Janine, meanwhile, is remarried to Chassigny, which they are now rivaling Hortense and Müller for evil people sex. The fact that two divorces and two remarriages have happened since the last episode is suggestive of a considerable lag in time, which we know because the last episode is in the last season is in the fall of 42, and this season is in the fall, September specifically, or it starts in September of 43. And, you know, a lot has happened in that time, which the show depicts mostly in elliptical references. So a few notes about what's happened in the lag. The first is that it is now pretty clear to a lot of people that Germany is losing the war, which is not true in the fall of 42, right? So they are now, we're now in like disaster for the Germans in the on the Eastern Front department. And you know, Chassigny and his new bride actually have a conversation about what happens if the Germans lose. You know, other people talk about when liberation, you know, when liberation happens, right? There's a kind of different vocabulary that has kind of caught on. And, you know, we're not yet at Normandy, right, where people know the modality of it and how it's going to happen. But there is a sense in the air that Germany is not faring well in the world. And actually, Müller articulates it very well, which is, you know, we lose a tank every 4 hours, and the Americans and the Russians, by the way, Americans now very much in the war, not just in a distant theoretical sense, but in a very on the ground kind of sense. You know, the Americans and the Russians are producing 10 of them, and it's just a matter of mathematics. And that's a, you know, that's a realization that is settling in this time, that Germany is just being outproduced industrially. And in a highly industrialized world, you cannot win a war being outproduced like that. So that's another thing. The third and big background related point is that Germany has responded to this by instituting its slave labor policy, which you know, was a big deal at Nuremberg, right? That Germany basically conscripted large numbers of French and other. They did the same thing in other countries they were occupying, young men and young women as well, and dragged them to Germany for forced labor. That policy is now up and running. It was not up and running when we left, and although it was, you know, sort of being talked about, and so you definitely have a very different atmosphere here. France is not merely under occupation now; it's not merely lost its autonomous zone. It's now having people basically conscripted into, you know, slave labor in factories in Germany. And of course, this fuels a very, you know, fuels the discrediting of the Vichy regime and fuels as well the rise of both the communists and the Gaullists in resistance.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to see, and I think they do a good job sort of depicting this on the show, how sending everybody's children, you know, like teenage sons. And that's what it is, right? You know, you see Chesnier get up and give this. Ben, were you not compelled by Chesnier's speech about why the Germans are spilling their blood? The least we can do is send them our young people to go work. I mean, yeah, come
because,
on, guys.
Because otherwise it's going to be the Bolsheviks and the Jews who are running Villeneuve.
We're going to run everything.
Which is really, you know, what I'm worried about.
Yeah, there is something about sort of Chesnier's, his verve in what is, and to be fair, this is at the beginning of the first episode, and then Mueller's speech about how just outgunned they are comes sort of at the second half, the back half of the second episode. But Chesnier is sort of throwing his whole self into what is already starting to become apparent as a lost cause, which I think is sort of interesting. I mean, he is throughout these episodes. I mean, he's such a revolting character, but you know, he you know, in the second episode when they start to take French, there's some of their soldiers have been shot. We'll get into why, but the response Mueller says is we're going to go arrest 50, and Servier protests and he says 100, and then Chesnier chimes in and said, 300, they killed three soldiers. We will send 300 prisoners for each. And he's, you know, he is basically trying to be, he's delighting in being a monster and in trying to, you know, be as vicious to the French people who aren't collaborating and get a gold star for being the biggest and baddest collaborator. But it's interesting to me that he's doing this at a time when the Germans, they seem pretty clear it's not going to go their way. And in fact, what sort of is the, you know, you see when they're sending these young men into the forced labor, their parents, they do kind of a pan shot across to the parents. You see how nobody is buying Chassagnier's speech. They hate this idea of sending their young people. And you can also tell that people have a different sense of the timeline, because rather than do the forced labor, you know, it starts this whole storyline about the young men running away to hide. Well, you don't go hide in the woods if you think that this is going to happen now for years and years, right? You think, I can wait this out because it's coming to a natural conclusion at some point.
Yeah. So, again, this is, I think, a fictionalized depiction of something accurate, which is when the German occupation was new, and it was not yet clear how monstrous it was going to be, and the Pétain government was the natural successor to the wartime government, it was, you know, it had pretty broad support, and it was thought of, and the early episodes of the show depict this. The marshal was our protector against the Germans, and sure, collaboration was just an adaptive strategy that was a reflection of the terms of the armistice, right? France had this armistice forced upon it, and it required certain things of it. And the collaboration was, you know, compliance with the terms of an armistice in a war that they'd lost. As the occupation, it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer what it is. And as it becomes, as the Germans themselves systematically violate the armistice, and as they start making demands that are wholly outside the terms of it, like, for example, you know, deport all your Jews, summer of 42, and now send us all your young men for slave labor, or even earlier, holding hostages, and the Vichy government is cooperating with this, this reduces and reduces and reduces the public appetite for the conduct of this government. And ultimately, the only people who support it are people who are actually hardcore fascists, right? It's not the, you know, the Daniel Larchets who, when he's confronted with his wife about Mueller, he's like, your boyfriend is sending people hostages to Germany, right? He's not involved anymore. He's just treating patients. And the only people who are involved are the actual ideological fascists like the Chassagnes, and of course the servile Servier, right? Who and the Marquetis, who is the police functionary, the functionaries of the state itself. But principally, you're concentrating the support in the people who are, most ideologically committed to something like what the Germans are about.
Yeah, and you see, Marchetti, he shows up in the first episode early on, and he's sort of like rounding up. He's going after somebody who has deserted, and it's clear that a lot of people are trying to avoid being conscripted into this policy, not just the Antoine and the young men we start following as they sort of gather in hiding. But when the camera's panning across the young men that are being sent while Chassagnier is giving his speech, you see that some of them are in handcuffs, right? They have been captured and pulled back in and being like, you're going. And Marchetti's job is basically now, just as he rounded up Jews, now he's rounding up young Frenchmen to be sent to Germany. Another quick Marchetti aside that I find bizarre on the passage of time is that he is now living with who we see.
Yeah, he's found a new woman to terrorize.
Right, but do you know who that is? I think that's the girl Raoul kissed.
Is it Eliane?
It is.
She didn't recognize her.
So it's weird. I had to like go back and look, and I remembered this from
again,
before too.
This is real evidence to our teenage listeners. Don't kiss people. It just leads to bad places.
So she both works at the sawmill, which I guess this is sometimes when I get like irritated with the show. I think it's great that we show and don't tell, but I also think I'm like, last we heard, she was leaving and taking her family, and it was actually a plot driver that she was going because it set off an information sort of line of communication. And now she is working at the sawmill and living with Marchetti in a way that the vibe of her living with Marchetti is though she has been like captured there. Like she seems like she is a hostage to him. There's no love between them. She seems sad and like she has nowhere to go, and he seems like he is just looking for somebody to be cruel to while he misses Rita, essentially. But it is the same person.
I had missed that entirely. Thank you.
Yeah. Well. So let's follow Antoine for a little bit here. So we'll just do his quick thread. We meet Antoine. He is. Because he works for Schwartz in the sawmill, he does not have to go into forced labor. But when Marchetti shows up and sees that somebody who is trying to avoid the forced labor is hiding at the sawmill, he shoots that guy in the back as he's running away and sort of meets Antoine under these circumstances and is annoyed by him and basically, turns him in for not going into forced labor. And so Antoine is conscripted. And Schwartz, his older brother-in-law, I will say the age gap between the sister and the brother is a little mystifying to me. Antoine appears to be, I'm always obsessed by these age gaps, but Antoine appears to be
He's 21.
He's 21. She is married to like 50-year-old Schwartz, the sister. She's probably
about 30 maybe, and maybe 35, and they all come from one of these big French Catholic families that, you don't know how many siblings are in between, right?
I guess. I wouldn't put her at 30, 35. But anyway, whatever. They are brother and sister. And so Schwartz is going out of his way to try to protect Antoine. Antoine is also helping him at the sawmill. He likes him, clearly, even though Antoine is headstrong and mouthy. and Schwartz, and he kind of fight. Schwartz is determined to help him. So he sets him up with a hideout somewhere, and it turns out there's another guy in the hideout, and we meet Claude. It is also fun to see Claude again. Claude is an acting student of the, you know, he's a student of the dramatic arts, which we see evidence of as he lies his way through the next couple of episodes. But one of the lies that Claude tells to Antoine is that they hear something outside. He tells them it's the cops. Antoine or Claude's parents have ratted them out their location. So they go and jump out the back window and run, where they meet up with another one of Claude's friends, Terry. So fun to see Terry. It is like, I don't really like any of the superhero movies like Avengers or anything, but I do like the whenever like the team is assembled, like that idea of teams being assembled. And so seeing these guys come together, Terry is hiding out in the barn of a farmer who's also important. And so they're all meeting each other for the first time. So these boys are starving. Antoine realizes Claude has lied to him. Wasn't the cops, but Claude just liked him. Thought it would be great if they all, you know, hung out together and went to live in the woods. And so they go to the woods and they meet sort of the rest of these guys who are already living there. And they're all starving. It's a bunch of young men who are all trying to avoid forced labor, living in the woods together, trying to cook chestnuts to eat. But you can see how this is the beginning of something special. But Ben, what did you make of all of our boys in the woods?
So I did not like this scene, just as a dramatic moment. I thought like
where Claude fakes cancer or what?
Well, this whole sequence of like, this is not a historical criticism. It's a dramatic criticism. You know, there's this whole, like, I think it dates back to at least to Shakespeare, where, you know, people run away and they find a fun loving gang in the woods. You know, and they're starving, but they're plucky, and they have a sort of joshing Nick Nolte, Eddie Murphy kind of relationship with one another. It's love hate, but it's more love than hate, and they take on the bad guys together. And I thought the fact that like the guy was an acting student and fakes, you know, lies a lot and fakes cancer and does the whole shtick was a little hackneyed, I thought. And particularly so for a show that actually doesn't engage in a lot of that. But I thought these were at least so far pretty stock characters. And, you know, and has a little bit of, found by the gang in the woods that's, you know, gonna take on the Vichys and the Nazis thing going. And I actually like the way the story develops, the much better the way the show develops the other resistance gangs that we see. Where, you know, for example, Marcel and Suzanne and the communists, as well as Marie, and where you have these plot lines that are much less devices and much more human stories of how people came to be doing the things that they were doing, both ideologically and just, you know, morally in terms of what they saw. So I thought there was something a little bit cheap, honestly, about this. And it's less about Antoine and more about Claude. But I keep waiting for like one of them to dress up as a bear or something. But like there's something like it feels like it jumped out of, the Scarlet Pimpernel or something.
Okay. I'm very sad to know that you feel this way because first of all, if you hate the boys hanging out in the woods, you might need to settle in. this is not quite a plot that goes away. I love these guys. Now, granted, I've spent time a lot more time with them, so we'll just see. My hope is that over time you fall in love with them too. And I gotta say though, you know,
I don't mind Suzanne and Marcel.
No. And we'll get to them. We'll get to them. But the one thing I'll is like, one of my best friends has just published a book called Into the Woods, and it is about the Jews who lived in the woods during this time. And I guess. And I've seen, you know, there's whole movies and like there's a canon sort of devoted to the Jews who went into the woods to hide and live and fight, you know, during this time. And so I guess that part, it felt more authentic to me than living in the woods because of that, that I know that there were people who did this during this time. And I guess I didn't feel, I mean, like Claude is a bit of a character that's, you know, different than what we've seen. But I guess, I don't know. I sort of liked that with these, because Antoine's, you can already tell a bit of a straight edge.
Yes. So look, there is no doubt there, a lot of people lived in the woods in these years. And, you know, the cities were really unsafe and the country, a lot of people fled to the countryside, and even within the countryside, the detail orientation of the French administrative state was such that being out of sight was really important. And so, you know, there were significant encampments of people of a variety of different, you know, of a variety of different types living in, you know, small encampments in the woods, for resistance activities and just for evasion of capture reasons. My objection is less to the living in the woods depiction, which is quite reasonable, and to the sort of bro-y nature of Claude and the depiction of Claude and Antoine's meeting, which did seem to me a little 48 hours-y.
Okay.
And I hope the Claude character, you know, gets the screenwriters get a handle. I know it's tempting to do shit with him because he's an acting student and, you know, you can make jokes about him being a liar, but also acting, and maybe they should fight about whether it's okay to steal chickens. But come on, that stuff is cheap. So, you know.
Jeez. All right. Tough critic. Tough critic of the male friendship
stuff. Okay. I don't, you know.
All right. Well, hold on. Let's get to it. I know that Suzanne is your, that's your happy space is when we're talking about Suzanne.
She is so. My hero. I love her. And I'm increasingly fond of Marcel, too, though he's a fucking commie.
Part of it is that we do get to see in these episodes Marcel finally say something, because he's a bit of like a communist robot, you know. He's just and you know somewhere deep inside there's this like burning passion that gives him this political, you know, whatever, but like most of the time when he talks he says things that are incredibly robotic, devoid of all feeling, and like also does things like Suzanne's whole story arc here is driven by the fact that she cannot stay away from her daughter. Her daughter has had to have surgery. She's going to, you know, organize a meeting so that she can go put her eyes on her kid. And like that, we haven't seen Marcel, you know, say boo about Gustav in a while.
I miss Gustav, by the way.
Yeah. I knew this when you and Kate and people were getting really attached to Gustav in the earlier episodes, I was like, oh, this, he loses his arc at some point. You know, we get to see Tequiero for about 30 seconds in these two episodes as well. But Marcel does in these episodes just like confess his love for Suzanne, and it's nice to see, and it's clearly nice for her to hear. But these are also like Suzanne is just like Marie. She emerges not just as like the woman in these groups of men who are part of the resistance, because there's sort of always sort of the tale of two resistance that we're sort of slowly seeing come together, which is the Barrio. Marie kind of flank that got taken out at the end of season three. And then there's the communists and the socialists that have come together. But Suzanne, more and more, is not just a part of that group, but she's the person devising the plans. And in this couple of episodes, she has a good plan. And she's trying to, you know, well, it goes a little south, but she is and Marcel are trying to figure out how they get weapons. And so they have figured out when a truck comes through, they see that it is not particularly well guarded. She figures out a way to get their hands on some uniforms by sort of playing a damsel in distress, so that they can, as cops, pretending to be cops, flag down a truck, which they do. Unfortunately, instead of carrying a bunch of guns, it just happens to that day be transporting a group of new soldiers. And so there is a firefight in which a couple of the young communists that we don't really know very well end up getting killed. And it also leads to the deaths of these German soldiers that then causes Mueller to have this conversation with Chassagnier and Servier about all the prisoners he wants to take. Even though he knows that taking the prisoners is basically at this time useless and will just increase the desire to join the resistance, which he just says flat out. But on the romantic side, Suzanne's husband comes back. He just like shows up. Like he kind of like
escaped from a German POW camp.
Yeah, and he's also like, but he's kind of like, he knows she's coming to arrange the thing with to see the kid, and he like pops in, like he's trying to, you know, catch her off guard. It's another scene, again, like Marie, where we have a woman seeing her husband return, and the look on her face is one of
thrilled.
not the least bit happy to see this guy. Also, I know these are cheap comments, but I would just like to say Suzanne is very much out of this guy's league. I do not know why she was married to this guy in the first place. This is what a drip of a guy.
Yeah, and he's a Pitanis, too.
That's right. They have a whole political conversation in which he's like, is it my politics? Is that why you don't want to be with me? And she's like, no, actually, it's all the other stuff. but it is so, and there's sort of this through line of Suzanne trying to get Marcel to just be like, fight for me. Like, say you want to be with me. And Marcel is like clearly jealous that this husband's here, but he's also saying dumb things like, well, your husband's back, I'll step aside, you know, and, you know, what do you want me to do, challenge him? And she's sort of like, yeah, dummy. Like, and I was also like, seems like a challenge is sort of unnecessary. It just seems like she can kind of say, hey, you're back, but things have changed. But that seems complicated for her.
Although she does it.
She does.
Look, this is a society in which divorce is still quite frowned upon.
Not among our characters.
Not among our characters, but actually, you know, the realistic example of this, I think, in that period is Hortense and Danielle, who just live apart, and, you know, she lives flagrantly with the enemy, and they are still married, as best as we can tell. And I think that's the more realistic or more typical thing. You know, this is the left of that society, so there's a little bit more. It's a little bit less infused by church expectations, but there was a. It is still, you know, not an obvious thing that when your husband comes back from the German POW camp, you do not have obligations to, you know, drop whatever came up in your life beforehand. So look, Suzanne, like Marie, has kind of taken a leadership role. The plan that she devises is actually a good one, and it is ultimately successful. Though they capture a bunch of weapons, although it has considerable casualties associated with it, and of course it generates reprisals. But you know, the, I suppose the larger drama of Suzanne in this pair of episodes, as you say, is that she kind of has to decide what comes first in her life. And I think she decides first is her role, second is Marcel, and a very distant third is the husband. And as a collateral matter, she is, you know, by voting with her feet, giving up the daughter as well.
Yeah, which I can't, I've never quite been able to, it is my, I've said this before, but like, it is my overarching and total complaint about the show, which is I just have, do not find, the way that children like Gustav, like Te Quiero, they end up as being plot drivers. I mean, Schwartz's kid is like long gone. And, you know, I just, the idea that is, I mean, just as a parent, that you're the absolute thing that wouldn't be driving you would be protecting your kids in some way. I mean, I guess, you know, this idea of sending people away to live somewhere safer is not crazy, and it's a good way to get the kids out of the plot.
But, I think this is the nature of the situation. If you're Marie and you're putting your kids first, you're not running a resistance cell, right? Then you're Lucien, and you're maybe tolerating what your husband's doing. But you're reminding him all the time that, you know, hey, we have a baby now, and I don't want you putting yourself in danger. And I do think the nature of the people that the show focuses on and that we regard in retrospect as heroic are people who were willing to say, you know, not quite fuck the kids, but you know, as, look, I mean, at the beginning, Cremieux says, no, we're not going to bust my family out because nobody's personal interests should be taken into account. And then, you know, his betrayal is when he, you know, goes against that and actually does, the moment you let those considerations affect your behavior is the moment at which Marketi has you by the throat.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in Marie's case, though, she's got these older, I mean, the second son, the younger son has disappeared. I don't know where he is. But the older one is, I don't know. I found it credible that she was bringing him into the resistance because he's like 17 or something.
How'd that work out for her?
It was not great at the end of season 3. I do believe, well, actually, I'm not going to say anything. We do see Marie. Marie, at the very end of the second episode, walks into the woods with the angry farmer who is mad at the guys for stealing his chickens. And I love seeing Marie. Love when she's back.
It's a pretty dramatic entrance there with the rifle.
With the rifle.
And the stern look and the windswept hair. She looks great.
She looks great. It's great to see Marie. Love to see Marie. And they're good. It's good. Good. And I was, you know, I like, and I love Suzanne's arc. I just will say with the, it makes perfect sense to me that Suzanne is trying to go see her daughter and that is a driving thing. And Marcel even like chastises her for doing it. And so you might be right that there was like a culture at the time of you do not put anything personal above this. I don't know. I just have a hard time getting my head into the idea that these kids just don't factor this way. But whatever. I don't know what else to say this. So let's just quickly do Lucien and Berio, though.
Yeah. They have an interesting couple episodes.
They do. And I'm excited to talk to you as the season unfolds about Lucien's particular arc and this new character that we've got. This singing teacher has shown up to the school, and she's a pretty young woman who just kind of says like, don't you know I'm coming? I'm the new singing teacher, and Lucien is like, well, I teach them to sing. Mario says, well, yeah, but she's a singing teacher. So it just sort of is like, she's here now. This is great. We'll give her a room. But Lucienne is very skeptical of this person and where she has come from, to the extent that she becomes a bit of a, you know, going through her things, reading her letters. And before I say who this person is, Ben, what was your reaction to this young woman coming on the scene?
So it's super cleverly written. It's totally unclear. Is she an actual resistance person as she represents to Berio? Is she a kind of false flag plant of some sort? Is she there to spy on them? Is she something else entirely? And Berio, in his wily way, is quite careful about her. He asks her questions. He listens to her. He learns, because she tells him, that she knows that he's involved in a resistance cell. But then he denies it to her. He does not accept her at face value. And she has this letter that is apparently from another resistance person, but is kind of written in without either in code or at least without showing a lot of its, or at least elliptically, that is, again, hard to discern whether it's a authentic or whether it's a, you know, an attempt to establish a legend for her. So we're left having very little idea who she is, except that she claims to be a resistance figure and is leading the children in nationalistic paeans to the marshal. And so, you know, I think that's, it's definitely setting up that question as, you know, one of the major tensions of that plot line in the current season. But I was unable to develop a hypothesis as to the answer.
Yeah. I think that's right. I remember this well and have lots of feelings about it overall, but there is the, like, Lucienne brings this sort of single white female energy to this particular plot line where she's like, you know, like weirdly obsessed with figuring this out. And like Berio's, even though Berio understands he's not sure where this person falls and has, you know, his reservations, he's also kind of like, let's just chill. And Lucienne is like over this, looking for Berio excuses to get into the room.
Berio's not a panicker.
Right.
He's a pretty cool cucumber. He has existed in this environment, people knowing that he's a national, that he's a constitutionalist and a sort of Third Republic guy, without, I mean, you know, that Servier and Chassigny want him arrested and interrogated, and Marquetti's like, you know, yeah, so he sings the Marseillaise, you know, he's done stuff in public, but he does seem to know where the lines are. That he can't cross. And Lucienne is much, much less worldly. She's much more conservative, and doesn't, like, I think she has a little bit more of a panic instinct with respect to this new person who shows up, and by the way, is living in their house. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like, you know, somebody at work who is, you know, who you don't quite get. It's somebody who's at work who you don't quite get, who's living with you.
Right.
And so I kind of understand where she's coming from. You know, if somebody showed up in my house, and my workplace, I had no idea where they were coming from, and I had no you know, nobody called me and vouched for them, I might go through their mail too.
Good to know. Good to know about Ben.
Well, wouldn't you? Would you be like all respectful of privacy? You don't know. You don't know if it's like somebody from, you know, sent by, I don't know, Dan Bongino, or all you know, all you know is they've moved into, you know, Shea Longwell, and they're showing up at the Bulwark every day and representing themselves as like, you know, an important Never Trump figure. You'd be like, and then they get a secret piece of mail that's from, you know, supposedly from Mar-a-Lago. You'd totally open the letter.
Boy, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I think the answer to that is no. This is like, I would never open somebody else's mail. Like, I would just find that.
It's really British of you.
I don't know.
It's freaking World War II, girl.
I
mean,
you're right. Well, I wasn't like Bill Kristol received communiques all the time. And I wasn't like, oh, I need to go through Bill's mail and make sure he's on the level, you know?
But Bill is somebody you knew and trusted. I'm talking about. Now it's somebody who just shows up one day.
Just like you did in my life. Ben would have showed up one day.
No, we met at P&P. Yeah. That's different.
It's true. Okay, well, that's good. You're defending Lucienne. That's good. You're not always on her side.
I'm okay with Lucienne's immoral behavior here.
All right. Is there anything else we've met? So the one thing I should just like hit this point, which is that Chassagne gets shot.
Good.
He does get shot, just like in the arm. Another guy gets killed. And there's like this is actually early on. It's like right after the, he's like posing for photos after he gives his speech about sending the kids off for forced labor. And there's a guy sort of like weirdly sweeping who turns around and shoots, I guess, his personal assistant, and then gets Chassagne in the arm. And it is actually part of the, they think that Berio, because it happens sort of on the school grounds, that Berio is somehow potentially connected, which it appears he is not at all. But one of the things about this shooting is that it's not a massive plot point, but it does create the overall atmospherics that are going on in these episodes where you're like, people are starting to push back. And whereas everybody was sort of, and then the people are cowed who are watching their sons be shipped off. But there is just resistance is in the air in a way that is different from before. And also, like, there's clearly more access to weapons among the people who are in the resistance. You know, it's a big plot point early on because there's the ban on guns. And you see Berio get yanked in just for having, like, his dad's old rifle that doesn't even work and almost gets him killed. And now, you know, the commies have enough guns to go hold up this truck. One of them's a machine gun, and they're doing it to get more guns. And so the being armed, as opposed to, you know, nobody having any sort of way to defend themselves, that is shifting and is notable.
Yeah. And the compunction about engaging in armed resistance is down. Remember in the early episodes when the communists, you know, decide to kill one German officer, this is a big deal, both because it's, you know, murder, but also because, you know, they're going to take hostages in response and execute a bunch of people. And, you know, now that logic is just gone, right? They know they're going to take hostages and, you know, ship 300 people to Germany, and they don't care. They're doing it anyway, right? And by the way, the Gaullists are, you know, we don't know that sweeper is a communist. He may be a Gaullist, right? They're doing it too. The logic that starts with Cremieu, where he says, yeah, they're right. It's the communists have this thing right, has now really spread. And that's a, that's a big cultural change.
That's right. Just the last plot point I'll just toss in for good measure is that Servier does show up to Marchetti's office and drop a file on his desk to say, hey, one of the guards who was guarding the border was shot and, you know, need you to take this seriously and look into it.
Which, of course, is the murder that he himself committed or that Marchetti committed in protecting Rita at the end of season three in the grand illusion moment of the end of season three. I assume that is setting up a plot development in which the police investigate Marchetti's murder of this guard. But really, it's just flagged in this episode.
Well, we will have to wait and see. Fred Jacobs, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you for being a super fan and for sending us all the fun stuff. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week to do episodes 3 and 4 of season 4.
Annie Dietz, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme s'aime tous les amants. Et puis...